The Rights to Ricky Sanchez podcast brought to you proudly by Big Barker Therapeutic Dog Beds. Get yours right now with the Process Pup Patch at bigbarker.com/Ricky. On the pod today, we will wrap up our draft coverage for 2019. I have a minor tantrum to kick off the podcast, and then we'll touch base with Ilan Vinokurov, our scout and the official scout of the Rights Ricky Sanchez podcast, to get his thoughts on the draft. And that's about it. One small free agency rumor we should address as well. Without any further ado, here is Run the Jewels.
We are the murderous pair that went to jail and we murdered the murderers there. Then went to hell and discovered the devil delivered some hurt and despair. Used to have powder to push. Now I smoke pounds of the kush. Holy, I'm burning the bush. Now I give a fuck about none of this shit. Jew runner over and out of this bitch. Step into the spotlight.
Welcome to the Rights to Ricky Sanchez podcast. I'm Spike Eskin, along with a guy who I think knows, but isn't sure. I'm not sure. Do you know that our Run the Jewels license is up in like a month and a half? Were you aware of that? Did I share that with you?
I had a vibe,
right,
in my mind that it was coming up, and I was just assuming we would maybe never say anything and just ride it out forever.
Well, we could probably do that.
But you're the legal correspondent to Cornwall, so I guess that's a little bit flat.
Somehow I've become legal correspondent, accountant. There's a bunch of things I don't know how to do. But we have a custom song on the way, is all I'll say, is that there is something custom coming for us.
Wow.
So that's exciting. By a Rights to Ricky Sanchez related character. So we'll see if it comes in time or if we end up paying $30,000 per podcast by using a song that we don't have the rights to.
I hope it's Amos and not like, I don't know, LL or something.
Well, do you really? I mean, when you think about it, if we got a song from LL?
Yeah.
We'll see. I don't know. So before we get going, I since the draft on Thursday night, I've been you know, we talked a lot about this, but I've been getting increasingly frustrated about the events of Thursday night and the last few years in general. And I've tried, and I hope that you have noticed that I've tried. I've tried since the Tobias trade, I guess, to, while being honest, maybe not be complainer guy all the time. You know, I'm trying to live in the moment and enjoy what's going on, but also make sure that people know how I really feel without that being the podcast every single time. And I hope that is obvious. But I guess I'm thinking about Thursday night, and I went and I read Derek Bodner wrote a pretty good breakdown of the value of the like picks at certain spots in the draft on The Athletic. And then as the days go by, our front office is such, it's like amateur hour. And it doesn't mean that Matisse Thybulle won't be a good player, and it doesn't mean that they might not succeed. Sometimes people with bad processes win a championship, like the Cavs, and sometimes those with good do not. But so it's not like the be-all, end-all over whether they succeed or not. But like, there's just, it doesn't seem like they have any idea how to do anything. And I'm just thinking about the everything that happened with Thybulle, that they telegraphed not only to pretty much every team in the league that that's what they wanted, but to fans and media alike. They were completely clear in the public about the sort of player that they were going to go after. So clear, and there were so many Thybulle vibes that basically every mock draft in America had them taking Thybulle at 24. So even if the Celtics were not smart and good at their jobs, they would probably have noticed that they had interest in him, along with the early reports that there was a promise somewhere in the 20s. And like, so to be so careless as to make sure that everybody knows that, and then to be so either egotistical or ignorant about talent evaluation in the draft to lock in so hard on one guy that every other result from the draft becomes a failure, especially to lock in so hard at 24. And again, this isn't like Thibault could end up being a very helpful player for us, but like a four-year senior who averaged 9 points a game, who, you know, and I know it's not just as simple as how many points a game you score, but sometimes it is a little bit. And it just seems crazy to me that they would do that. And it seems like every situation in which they overpay, it's because the other team knew they were stuck. I have to imagine that the Tobias Harris trade in part, and we always talk about them like giving up one thing too many. I think we talked about this on Thursday. You have to imagine that the Clippers knew. They just knew. They knew that they were locked in and they wanted them and they were not willing to go the rest of the year without a player of that level. And so they can demand that. And I'm aware that when you're trying to win, it becomes harder to win trades. But to lose in such a careless way and to treat the draft in such a, and Derek made the point that they just, their actions show and their words show their complete devaluation of second round players. And calling them, like, what if we do this? What if we just don't say that there are rounds at all? What if we just say that there's a 24th pick and a 33rd pick? And the only difference is that you don't have to promise the 33rd pick any money at all. There's no guaranteed money at all. It's baffling to me. And the number of times that they do this and the number of times that there are extra picks and players and all of this spent on moving forward, it catches up to you. It has caught up to them here, you know? It's caught up to them in that if that free agency is basically their, like, they don't even have a trade to make. Like, they can't even really make a trade at this point of any value because all of their future assets are gone most of their future assets are gone. I'm just really disappointed at ownership for allowing basically like, and none of this means that any of these guys are bad people. I'm sure they're very good people. Alex Rucker, Ned Cohen, Mark Eversley continue after Brian Colangelo and have so much say. And then to have a situation in which they hire one of the guys that went for the job in Elton and that all the other guys who went for the job are still there and supposedly like, oh, we're all supportive. This is a totally good team. We're all for teamwork. Like, that's bullshit. That's not how the world works. If one person gets promoted and everybody else went for the job, those other people, at least some of them, are not happy with that, think they should have the job, and that certainly affects their, like, how they work together and their interactions. And I'm disappointed that we are moving into such a crucial time. And by the way, like, you can, and then I'll stop. You can talk about losing every trade, and the good team to point to is Cleveland in the LeBron era, how they had to overpay for every vet that they got. But why are we pretending like Joel Embiid at 25 and Ben Simmons at 22, neither of whom, who by the way, have shown the aptitude to being like a championship level closer at any point, is the same thing as a 32-year-old LeBron James on an expiring contract or a one-year deal. They're not the same thing. You don't have to act with the same sort of urgency. There's not a right now sort of sentiment to all of that. And I guess that's it. And I'm just, I am hopeful and optimistic given everything that everybody has said about Matisse Thybulle that he will be effective. But the way they went about getting him is unacceptable. And the way that the front office has operated, aside from, here and there, has been unacceptable since Sam Hinkie left 4 years ago, 3 years ago. So that's it. I'm done. Sorry it took so long. I have felt like I had to get it out.
Yeah, I mean, those are a lot of really good points. As you were talking, I was just thinking, like, when is the last time the Sixers had leverage?
Right.
In like, anything. Like, dating back to the Nerlens and Jaleel stuff. It just feels like since the Colangelo regime got here, it's been, like, tunnel vision on the thing that we want. And everything else, any other, like, flexibility, optionality is just, like, totally gone. And it's like, if we don't get this one thing, then we're fucked. If we don't...
Right.
Everybody knows that the Sixers want Matisse Thybulle that they're willing to pay out their ass for Tobias Harris, that they don't really want to keep Jahlil Okafor, that they don't want to keep Nerlens, that they don't want to keep Markel. Like every single time point in this in the past few years, it's been never dealing from a position of strength. Maybe in the Jimmy Butler trade, you can say that Minnesota had less leverage than we did. And that was a fair, reasonably fair trade. So it's frustrating. There's a lot of people, I don't think nobody's making the case that second round picks don't matter. Like, right. Everybody has a proper evaluation, maybe except for me, of like, yeah, it's probably gonna be nothing, but you know, you want a bunch of different bites at the apple. That's the whole thing. That's obviously the case at the number one pick and a high in the lottery for years and years. We got a couple, and we got an Embiid and Simmons, and we got a Fultz and an Okafor. Like, it's not always going to hit. It's the weird shit's going to happen, whatever. And it's the same, even, I think, more magnified in the late first and into the second round, in that, like, there's talented guys. They've dropped for some reason. Some people, whether it's that they don't think that they're how good they were in college isn't going to translate to the NBA, or that they're too small for some reason, or that they have character concerns, whatever. The Sixers got a guy, Matisse Thybulle, who's a really good kid, takes pride in being like a glue guy, role player type. Very handsome, which, as we know, is very important to this team and to us. And I think he's going to be great, but I think there's a lot of guys in that range into like the early 40s, who are also really very good and have a real shot at being NBA players. And the Sixers got tunnel vision. They decided, we're not making these picks. We have no interest in it. They have arbitrarily just deciding that like four is the maximum amount of people on a rookie contract that we can stomach. And not like, look, if Jimmy or Tobias leaves and we just get left with one of them, like that's gonna be shitty. Like and we traded the 33rd and 34th pick and 42nd pick for like fucking nothing. Like it's like, well, we could have used that, or at least use that pick as leverage in a trade later. And maybe they still can.
To your point about leverage, here's the thing about the Thybulle trade is that it's not that they don't have leverage, it's that they operate as if they don't have leverage. Here's the leverage in the Thybulle thing. You can take somebody else. I know that that's the guy that you want. I understand. But it's the whole thing was so sloppy in that what they realized that everybody knew. So they started, that's when the, who's the guy that went 11? The Cam Johnson, is that his name?
Yeah.
That's when those rumors started. And then mid-draft, it's like, ooh, they're going after Kevin Porter Jr. and Nas Little. And
yeah, Keith was very willing to battle that.
It's like, oh, well, hopefully, why don't you just send a text to Danny Ainge and tell him, no, you're not interested in Matisse Thybulle. These are actually the guys that you're interested in. Just keep them updated. That way you can.
Yeah, it's a joke. I don't mind having a board. It's just, what was the actual value of having a guy telling him basically to like shut it down and to go tunnel vision on Matisse Thybulle? Was it so that like, okay, so none of the teams higher up get a decent look at him after 4 years at Washington, and also that way you won't have to trade up to get him. Well, you had to trade up to get him anyway. It failed. You're like,
right.
It wasn't good. I mean, right. it's frustrating that the Sixers are one of those franchises that like can only lock in on things. Like it feels like it feels very Bulls-ish. It feels very like former Wolves regime. I don't know if Rosas will be better. Really excited about Jarrett Culver and Robert Covington on defense together, though.
That'll yeah. And by the way, Rosas and Sachin Gupta is like a kind of a neat. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. We can take credit for that.
Yeah, for sure. And I guess I would just Yeah.
It just adds up, right? And yeah, I said this a million times in the last podcast. It just adds up. And this is something that I've, over the course of me and Alyssa's relationship, my girlfriend's a Lakers fan, like, I've pointed out that, like, the Lakers just feel like because they're the Lakers, they can cut corners. They don't have to develop guys in a certain way. They don't have to prove that they're a smart organization, because guys will just come there in free agency because they're the Lakers and there's prestige and it's LA and all that stuff. And the Lakers have that. They can say, well, fuck it, whatever, we're the Lakers. And the Sixers, and now that the Sixers are like kind of doing that also, not in the same sense, but in the similar like cutting corners of like, ah, fuck it. Like, ah, fuck it here, there, like, ah, whatever, whatever, whatever. Just like not seeing things through all the way. It's going to come back to bite them. It's just going to add up and work against them.
And you know, I like Elton a lot, but that press conference afterwards, like even the way he talked about,
yeah, it's painfully like obtuse.
Yeah, second rounders don't help you win. Well, of course they don't help you win right away, but all you need to do is look at the fucking finals and see, like, you know, Pascal Siakam, who was taken 24th or whatever, 27th, and then Fred VanVleet, who was undrafted, and then Kyle Lowry, who was taken 24th, by the way. Like all these guys who on both teams, Serge Ibaka was taken 27th, I think. All these guys on both teams in that area, when you just look at this draft and this draft alone, we could have had, instead of having the 20th pick, 24th, 24th, 31st, 33rd, 34th, even if you miss out on Thybulle, I'd be willing to bet that you have as good a chance of having a rotation player by taking those four picks than taking the one. And your necessity in trading up from 24 to 20 and increasing Thybulle's salary basically caused that Jonathan Simmons trade to be necessary at all. Yep. Because your $400,000 increase is then mitigated by the $333,000 stretch and
yeah,
cut.
So it was
stretched.
Really 24, 33, and 42 for 20.
Yeah, right.
So. Frustrating. And look, I mean, again, like, I don't expect the Sixers to carry 6-7 rookie type players. I don't. But there's no harm. It rather than selling a pick for cash, draft a guy and get him in your system. Let them see them up close, play their asses off, play them in summer league. And if it doesn't work, offer them a two-way. Like, there's no big problem with offering the 33rd, 34th pick a two-way. If they don't accept it, fine. I understand. You shot your shot. You wanted to see, whatever. And then you can go from there. Like, I'd just rather have competition in training camp and let the best guys win than just like, oh, we're never going to carry all these guys. And I said it before and I tweeted about it, but like, Elton, drafting a guy in the second round, you don't have to play him this year. I know. I understand rookies are tough. But in a year, he's not going to be a rookie. In 2 years, he's really not going to be a rookie. Like,
imagine it. Yeah.
They'll get better over time and could grow into the core of this team. And just because you're like, ah, I don't want him, don't want to deal with him, it's frustrating. And I know, I'm sure that the coaching staff were like, no more rookies, but like, Grant Williams isn't a rookie. Carson Edwards isn't a rookie. There's guys that aren't going to have to like go through that like painful, what is the NBA learning curve development that I believe Matisse will also have an easy time going through because he's a good kid and a role player and fine in his space. Anyway, it's frustrating, but you know, we got a good player that hopefully will. Let's talk to Alon about and see what he says.
Yeah. So before we get to Alon, two things. First, the Willie Green Apple Podcast 5-star review. Please leave us 5-star ratings on Apple Podcasts. When we get to 3,000, I will read all the reviews. This comes from Run It Back 19. The subject line is, "Where did the sirens go?" A podcast where people will give 5-star review just to have their Sixers question answered on the pod. This is everything you need to know about the Sixers and the LA crime rate, which seems to be at an all-time low. A must listen if you want extra stress in your life. So people wondering where the sirens are. And before we get to Alon, let's talk about our sponsor, Big Barker Therapeutic Dog Beds. Alon, get ready because you're going to need to bark like a dog at the end of this commercial. It's part of the deal. dog beds are important. They might seem like a throwaway, but they're important. It's where your dog is spending their evenings. If your dog sleeps on it during the day, it's where the dog could spend another 6 hours during the day. And the support it gives the dog's joints is important, which is why you can't cheap out on a dog bed. You just can't. Get the best one, the only one engineered by experts to keep dogs over 50 pounds, super healthy, also great for dogs under 50 pounds, like Rebel, 40 pounds. How many pounds is Donovan? Do you know?
I would say like 21, 22.
There you go. And sleeping comfortably.
Very comfortably.
Get your Big Barker dog bed with a process pup patch. It's the only way you can get it. Go to writes2rickysanchez.com. Or no, rather, I always do that. Go to bigbarker.com/Ricky. Bigbarker.com/Ricky. Get your dog with the process pup patch. Then send us a picture of the dog to writes2rickysanchez@gmail.com. We'll post them on the website. And I always say this, that Big Barker's not cheap, right? But it lasts for 10 years. There is a 10-year warranty that the foam doesn't flatten or they replace it for free, and a one-year at-home trial. So if your dog won't sleep on it or doesn't like it or you don't like it, they will pay for the full refund, even the shipping. The mattress promotes enhanced energy and mobility levels in older dogs and reduces wear and tear on younger dogs. If you're like me, the living thing in this world that is most important to me, do not tell my family or my wife, is my dog. And that's why my dog is worth that investment. Again, bigbarker.com/Ricky. Handmade in the United States. Big Barker dog beds.
Oh, woof. Woof.
Your turn, Elon. Bark.
Really nice. That's a, wow. Scout. That's a scout type bark.
Elon is
really
all
in. Full-bodied bark. I think good movement on the bark. I can keep going, but let's just dive in. Thank you for coming back, Elon. Welcome.
What's going on, guys?
So I was listening to Joe and John on WIP the day after the draft, and they replayed the thing from the day before of you basically pointing out that Matisse Thybul would be a good fit for the Sixers. And we talked about him when we had him on. I guess just your wrap up with that pick at 20 for the Sixers, and I guess the notion of trading up to it, and then their pick at, which one do they keep, 54 or 57?
54.
54, yeah.
Well, I think Matisse Thybul's is great value at 20. Like, I really thought that was a prime target for the Sixers, somebody that we really liked as a staff. He was one of the guys I didn't want to reveal where we had him ranked. We had him 13 overall, so we had him as a lottery pick. Thought that's, you know, getting him at 20, great value. I don't think he would have been there at 24. I really think OKC might have been a team that was considering him. There were rumors that they had promised in pre-draft. Clearly, it was the Sixers who had promised him, though I still think he lines up with some of the things Oklahoma City looks for in guys to balance and play around Russell Westbrook and Paul George. Mm-hmm. Would they have needed to trade up? Who knows? People are going to say things now that we never know if they're going to be true or not. Giving up the pick hurts. But if the Sixers really do feel like he's somebody that's a seamless fit, is going to be, you know, able to play right away, all those things, then I think, I guess you got to do what you got to do. Time will tell if he really is playing right away, which I'm very curious to see how much Matisse Thybul plays out the gate.
Yeah, in talking to teams, just to stay broad before we get further into Matisse's game, when you talk to teams and organizations, like, does it separate the good teams from the bad teams, and not record wise, like good organizations from bad organizations, in terms of people that are like, we don't want to carry this many rookies? Does that, like, that philosophy and that, like, we don't really give a shit about this stuff, does that permeate bad organizations, or is it kind of just all over the place depending on personnel?
It kind of feels like that is, everybody has their own way of spinning that sort of sentiment. I don't know if everybody would vocalize it that way, but I think if you just look at the way that the draft played out, right? Like, only, I would say, about 13 guys that were drafted, teams drafted them without the intention of them taking up one of the roster spots. So that means that they're either going to be a draft and stash guy, or they are a handshake two-way, or they're hoping that the guy plays their way with summer league into a two-way, and the guy thought, I have no chance of getting drafted, so there's not a lot of expectation that he's getting some sort of contract right away. Like, summer league is going to dictate that. And I think we're going to see at least another two or three more guys who are drafted not wind up on rosters because they don't play well in summer league or something happens, they're not as good as we think they are. So let's just say 45 guys out of the players that were drafted this year are going to wind up on a roster this season. And that means no two-way and obviously not draft and stash. That's a weird trend. And that to me says that teams don't want to waste roster spots on younger players. I'm not sure if that's because there's more value and there's more talent in the league than we've ever seen. And maybe we're underplaying how hard it is to play in the NBA and what that bar is that a rookie has to be above in order to carry any sort of a value on a roster spot. Or if it's just as simple as teams are saying, this is a weak draft. I only have 35 guys on my board this year. Why would I value a pick in this range? I don't know. What I do know is it's kind of unsettling that the best 60 players in this draft were not the 60 players that got drafted. And maybe that's just the basketball purist in me who is saying the draft should be a reflection of the best 60 prospects in the pool. And I don't think that was the case this year more than ever. And I'm not really sure yet what to take away from that outside of it feels uncomfortable moving forward. And it's a weird trend that we're not actually valuing the best 60 players. We're valuing something else entirely, which may not age very well.
Like what is, I guess even just a lot of it is on the players, right? In especially in the back half of the second round, the last 10 or 15 picks or so, it's teams saying, hey, if we draft you, will you agree to a two-way? And there's a lot of guys that say no. At that point, they'd rather make their own decision as to where they want to go, an undrafted free agent. Lou Dort is a guy that I think of. I liked him. I didn't love him. Has a lot of development to go. But, like, what's the harm in, at 54, the Sixers can go, I don't really care if this guy is agreeing to it on draft night or not. We like him. We want him. We're going to draft him and then see what happens and take Lou Dort there.
I guess the harm is that you develop a rocky relationship with an agent to where then you're heading into summer league and you're going to summer league thinking, how are we going to make sure Matisse Thybulle looks good? How are we going to make sure Shake Milton's taking that next step? And instead, you're being pestered by Lou Dort's agent. And I'm not actually calling out Lou Dort's agent specifically.
Right,
I'm just using him as an example. And then he's calling you and saying, why isn't Lou playing more? Lou needs to be playing 30 minutes a game. Are we signing him to a contract? And it's, do you want to be dealing with that level of kind of annoyance at summer league when you have a million other things on your plate, whether that's, you know, potentially interviewing new people for your staff, making sure your rookies and second year players are progressing accordingly, making sure they're not getting into trouble in Vegas. Like, there's just a lot of things going on. And I've heard of players with way less clout and way less on the line, like guys that were not even drafted, who were not expected to be drafted. I've heard of their agents calling people on the staff complaining that their player is not playing enough. So that happens. And I think if you kind of force a player to join your team when the agent says, no, thank you, that might have an effect that ripples down a couple years from now, whether it's like dealing with that player when he needs an extension, if that player actually turns out to be good, or whether it's trying to get that agent's free agent years down the line. And I think teams are always afraid of getting into some sort of a, like, just weird spat with an agent that's going to not age well on terms of future decisions that they have to make.
That makes sense. I get it.
Yeah, that's good. I appreciate the, as somebody who works with teams regularly as you do, I appreciate the honesty in all of that too. It's so hard. It's funny, like we see things and we hear things. This is everybody, not us, but you know, trying to figure out and evaluate what teams really think and how they really operate is tough for everyone, I think. You know, they can say one thing and mean another. It certainly feels like, it's funny, after the Sixers with Sam were so, untransparent in what they were thinking and what they were doing, that currently it just seems like they say exactly what they're going to do and then they have to do it. I appreciate getting the insight from you. So Thybulle, one question I had about Thybulle, Mike, if you're okay going into him directly.
Yeah.
So the shooting numbers, free throw shooting, and even the 3-point shooting, senior year aside, are pretty good. But I watched more YouTube on him, and it does seem like he's not like, it's not that he can't shoot at all, but it definitely doesn't seem like it. My guess would be that NBA speed will be different for him, and he is a guy that people won't worry about leaving open at the NBA three-point line, at least immediately.
Well, I don't think it's so black and white. Like, to me, the guys that are left open completely are just complete non-shooters, guys that are mentally in their own head, have that flinch where somebody passes them the ball and they're like semi-open, but they don't rip it right away. I don't think that's Thibault's problem. I think he's just kind of like a fit-in type of mentality. He's not a, like, afraid and timid mentality. And so, to me, he was a role player, someone that needed other people to kind of make him look good. Jalen Noel is very much a scoring combo who just tried to use this year to showcase, hey, I have any percentage of point guard ability. David Crisp is, like, one of the more selfish point guards in the country. He is who he is. He's just a jack. And, you know, Washington at times rode that when his hand was hot, but he made no one around him better. And there was really nobody on Washington to make Thibault look good. So I don't think he looked good on that team as a role player who needed to rely on other players. His shot versatility is not really diverse whatsoever. He's very much a catch and shoot guy right now. You're not running him off of pin downs. He's not pump fake and relocating for a one dribble pull up. That's just not who he is. And when you look at his mechanics, I don't think there's anything wrong with them. I think he's got a high release point, and he raises his elbow, which then leaves his tricep not necessarily parallel to the ground. He kind of shoots off of his palm and not his fingertips. But there's no hitches. There's no kinks. I don't think there's anything mechanically flawed. He doesn't have any weird leg kicks. He's not fading in the wrong direction. His shot feels to me very coachable, and I like the free throw touch. 85% is good. He shot 36.5% from three as a junior, and it's not like his peaks and valleys were completely like, this guy's fluky. It's just weird. Like, I can't really explain the monthly shooting splits, but it doesn't feel to me like this kid is broken as a shooter in any way. I really just feel as if there needs to be a talking point here as a weakness, and the shooting is the obvious swing skill, so it gets a lot of attention. But I would not be shocked if in a couple years he's fine. Like, that doesn't mean he's going to be 42% from three, but he could very comfortably be in that 38.5%, have sometimes where he's a little bit higher, sometimes where he's struggling, and that's enough to be guarded, and I think he'll be there.
There's two things that I'm encouraged by when I look at the shooting numbers. One is, as a sophomore, when he was playing with Markelle Fultz, a dynamic dribble drive point guard with vision at one time in his career, he shot 41% from three. And in the last 2 years under Mike Hopkins without Fultz, it's been a very stagnant, dull offense that really doesn't do anything unless Thibault's getting steals in transition and leaking out. The second thing being, his two-point percentage has gone up each year from 43% as a freshman, 49% as a sophomore, 52.5% as a junior, and 55.5% as a senior. And so that tells me he works in the mid-range sometimes, and he's hitting that at a reasonable clip, and he's getting a lot of buckets at the rim and finishing well. Did both of those things jibe for you?
Yeah, for sure. And I think he's going to be somebody that can very comfortably attack a really kind of just bad closeout. He's by no means going to be breaking people down off the dribble, but he is quick in terms of his first step, and he's got good routes to the rim. I always just felt like the dribble needed to be tighter to kind of keep up with his speed. He's fast in the open court. He's a good finisher. He's not a diverse, complex, like, attack and contact finisher, but that's not what this team is going to ask him to be. It's going to be make the open layups, and I think he's, like, a way better finisher than someone like Robert Covington was at 22 years old. To me, the biggest question is, how quickly can he be serviceable as a shooter to where he has confidence, Ben Simmons has confidence, and the team has confidence to just kick him the ball and shoot? And then when does he start adding new shots to his repertoire? Like, when do you actually start running him off of a screen? When do you start letting him just run off ball in general and freelance a little bit? And then maybe that turns into, like, people overplaying him and he backdoor cuts for, like, an alley-oop layup or just a really nice reverse finish. To me, like, if he doesn't evolve as that, then he's a kind of vanilla player offensively. But those things are in there. And with hopefully more creative coaching and better players around him, I think that could happen. Like, a guy like Danny Green played with a lot of talent at UNC. Matisse Thybulle, I don't think any of those guys are NBA players. Noah Dickerson, David Crisp, I don't think Jalen Noel's an NBA player. So he played with no NBA players this year. And I think playing with real talent in the NBA is going to make him look better. We don't talk about that enough for a guy like Thybulle.
Yeah, is it weird? When we were talking about Mie Oni from Yale, you were saying you wanted him to take over a bad league and take over the team and make it his team and just dominate if he's going to be an NBA player. Obviously, the Pac-12, not a little better, but this year, kind of not. Does it concern you that, you know, Spike was saying earlier before you got on, like, he's a guy who averaged 9 points per game. And so does it concern you that with a lack of NBA players, he, as a role player, fit in so deeply as a role player that he didn't even dominate there? Or is he just such a glue guy that you're fine with it?
I definitely don't want to say that, like, what Spike is saying is valid, and that has to be part of a conversation if you were to talk about Thibel for 10 hours in a war room. But in my opinion, he's one of the few guys that kind of played the role in college that you'd like to see him play in the NBA, but the role is going to look a lot cleaner with better players around him, and it's going to just make him look better naturally. So he's never had the game or the mentality or the skill level, really, to be a do-everything player. I just don't think that's who he is, and I think mentally he very much grasps being a role player in a way that most college players don't. And I think that, to me, is why he'll translate so well into the NBA level. And it's also a guy where he's got some skills that could look better in the pros with spacing, with help, not just shooting, but he's actually not a terrible passer within the flow of an offense. He's by no means a decision maker, playmaker, dribble, dribble, pick and roll guy. But he can make a read. Like, he's not somebody afraid to do anything with the ball. His basketball IQ isn't bad. Everything is just through a role player lens. And I don't think that's a problem. But if you think this kid has some sort of, like, super high upside to where he's going to 5 years from now, 6 years from now, be unrecognizable, I don't see that at all. That's not who Matisse Thybulle is. But that doesn't also seem to be what this team is looking for.
Yeah, I guess it's funny to pick a guy and know that his ceiling is role player. You know, like, that's the, and we've spent so many years, even last year, when the Sixers made the trade to go from Bridges to Smith and get that extra pick, it was sort of the opposite of that. And then to draft a guy that you're like, now Mike mentioned Tony Allen, Robert Covington, like, that's, those guys are fucking phenomenal defenders. I mean, like, you know, top five in the league wing defenders. And Covington as a shooter was a much, 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 much more prolific shooter than Thybulle is, in both in college and in G League and then in the NBA. But it is interesting to pick a guy that you're like, you know what, he may never even be a starter, but he, you know, he could give us 20 minutes at some point. Is just different for us, I think, as Sixers fans.
Yeah, and I don't think, I would never say he can't be a starter. I think that's
right.
That's definitely in the equation here. And it, look, you know, when you look at Danny Green and Robert Covington, two guys that I think of when I think about Matisse Thybulle in terms of his upside, those guys are better shooters in college. And the guys on our staff who are not in love with Thybulle, he was not a consensus lottery pick, were the guys that said, I can't ever see him being the type of shooter that Green and Covington are. So I get that. It's not, he's not bulletproof as a player. And if you walk away from him and say, do I feel great about drafting somebody with this type of ceiling at pick 20 when we could have stood back, gotten somebody different, maybe his ceiling was comparable or slightly higher, and then we could have taken a couple more swings in the second round? I get that approach too. I mean, coming from my background where I love the second round, I always think there's value to be had there, I might actually, if I was drafting, I might lean more towards that second approach. But if you really think this kid can kind of just magically look better in the areas where he was, you know, had question marks just by playing with better talent, which I think is totally on the table, and if you trust his makeup, which I think is squeaky clean, and he's like an A-plus kid, another positive, you know, feather in his cap, then I get it. But I'm really curious. Like, I keep coming back to this. When we're in October, when we're in November, is he going to play? Is he going to play 20 minutes per game? Is he going to play 18 minutes per game? Or is the team going to re-sign Redick, sign another wing to be on the bench, and this kid's playing 3 minutes or barely playing or swinging back and forth to the G League? If that's the case, I don't know. I mean, it kind of starts raising question marks for me about what you gave up to get him, how much you actually valued him, and what you actually realistically thought about him and how true all those things were.
Before we get, I want to get to the defense as something, but I want to stay on the offensive end for a quick second. Just talk to him. You mentioned his cutting off ball and his passing vision, which I think is pretty high. Talk to me about, you know, a lot of times rookies, they just tell kind of stand in the corner. Basically, the few minutes that Zaire played last year, it was very just like, please stand in the corner and don't fuck up. Talk about like Matisse's ability to make reads off of that and make back cuts and, you know, various pin downs and those kinds of things.
Well, don't you also think that that's the offense? Like, not to flip this on you really quick, but don't you think that that is the offense for players like Thybulle and players like Zaire to just stand around and watch, unless you're Redick and you're running off of a dribble handoff, or you're Jimmy Butler and you're playing a pick and roll, or you're Embiid and you're doing the, you know, the 3-point pump fake? Like, has there been any sort of creative usage of the fifth guys on the floor?
No, usually it's a stand there. But there's sometimes when you look at, you know, my first thought for whatever reason is like Pat Connaughton. Like, he stands in the corner and then occasionally it's like a hard back cut for like an alley-oop type thing. Does Thybulle have that ability and the quickness of making reads on offense off ball?
He definitely has that sort of ability. I just don't know if that's the offense. And like, I hope that that can be the offense moving forward. I think that's hard when you have guys that dribble as much as Butler, Ben, and Joel do. That's not an easy thing to, I think, build in. And I think just from a basketball player mentality standpoint, when you're watching people dribble, 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 and they're not really scanning the whole court, your natural inclination is just to stand still. And I think that's what's happening here with the fifth options. I think Thybulle has the potential to be way more than that, to be somebody that cuts, that is smart, that moves, that can be, doesn't have to just be somebody standing in concrete. But it doesn't matter if that's not what this offense is going to evolve into. Yeah, he has that ability, but this offense needs to evolve into that as well, which is something that has more than just two things going on.
Can you talk, pivoting a little bit to defense now, can you talk about the fit between Zaire and Thybulle on the defensive end? Because Zaire is a similar, like, game-changing defensive player, but they have different strengths.
Yeah, I mean, to me, Zaire's more of a stopper, and that's the idea. And Thybulle is more switchy, disruptive, taking chances on the weak side, trying to be somebody that could chase around a Redick-type off-ball, and then when the pass comes there, just jumps it. That's the idea with Thybulle. The idea with Zaire is he could guard somebody a lot bigger than him. He could hopefully guard somebody smaller than him and kind of cool somebody off when they get hot. Now, I don't think Zaire actually showed that he was ready to do that in the limited minutes that he played, but he also really had a rough start to his rookie season. I would just say one is more switchy, versatile, deflection-oriented, and the idea with Zaire is more of a stopper, a little bit more, I would say, actually high energy, and somebody that is making splash plays more like on the offensive glass than anything.
Just how rare and unique is it that even at the top of the zone, Matisse Thybulle averaged 3.5 steals and 2.3 blocks per game?
Oh, those numbers are ridiculous. I mean, it's completely unheard of. And had he played in a man defense, he never would have averaged them. If you watch a lot of his plays where he's stealing the ball or blocking a shot, you'll notice that he crosses over into David Crist's responsibility a lot. And a lot of times, his range and his kind of responsibility in that defense was just far greater than Crist's. He could go wherever he wanted at the top. He could sag back almost into the back, and he could do whatever he wanted. And a lot of that doesn't translate well, but I think if you go back and you watch his tape from freshman and sophomore year when he played under Romar and he played in more man defense that switched everything, he had no problem switching. He was always communicating. Like, he's not going to have the issues that we think about when we think about zone defenders and guys coming from the Syracuse zone, which is really what the Washington zone was. But we also can't expect the shot blocking and steals to translate the way that we saw them in the Washington defense. That would just be uneducated, and that's not really a fair expectation.
Of course, but not everybody that plays at the top of the zone gets those kind of numbers.
No, I mean, he's the rare complement of, like, his ability to cover ground, his instincts, and them letting him do that. And I think it's very, very rare, the numbers he put up. We don't see that very often. It's also just as rare coming from a zone defense and being a high-level defender in the NBA. So we're going to see, I guess, what ends up happening with him, and he'll be a good case moving forward for guys that average the steal and block numbers that he did in a zone and what we think about them in their transition to the NBA.
Yeah, you mentioned Syracuse, and that's I don't know if we talked about it when we had you on, but I sort of have, as a Syracuse graduate and looking at the number of guys that come from Syracuse in the NBA with block numbers, and then they get to they get to the NBA, and all of a sudden it goes away. How difficult is it for somebody who played that sort of zone in college, and especially Thibault, who played for years that sort of zone in college, to get to the NBA and like the adjustment to NBA defense, which is so different? Like, can you talk about the difficulty and then the success rate of them going from playing that sort of defense to NBA defense?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely difficult just battling with screens, being able to communicate and hand off screens, being able to chase somebody around and then sag into the right position to kind of be two passes away versus one pass away, especially at that age, right? Like, when you're talking about somebody that's a senior, you want somebody that can come in and you know what you're going to get out of them defensively. And for Thibault, that has to be a minor question mark in terms of his immediate impact and ability to play man. Now, you look at the Syracuse zone and you look at products like Wesley Johnson, who's been, I guess, passable defensively at best, Jeremy Grant, who's on the higher end, but mm-hmm. plenty of other guys have struggled, whether it's like a Johnny Flynn type or if you go big like Rakeem Christmas. It's not easy leaving that zone. And even more, I would say, for someone like Thibault, who took a lot of chances. Like, guys that gamble and kind of cheat a little bit defensively, they're in for a rude awakening when they have to close out, because his closeouts are often a little bit more wild. They're not as controlled. They're not as clean and balanced. And I think guys could get by him, and he could afford to do that because then they're going into your second line of defenders. And when you're in a wide open spaced NBA, that's a layup. So I think it's certainly not easy. And I've spoken to many NBA teams who will say, I don't know, nobody comes out of the Syracuse zone and defends. Jeremy Grant's like an anomaly, especially because he left school early. He wasn't there for 4 years. But I do think Thibault, at least the fact that he didn't play all 4 years in a zone and that he's got the right makeup, smarts, and mentality, where I don't think it's going to be an issue. I also think it does raise question marks about how quickly he can pick up on man defense.
And his freshman and sophomore year block and steal rates were also very high. Not like world-changingly high, not break Gary Payton's record high, but still very high for even in man-to-man.
For sure. And if you go back and watch, I mean, a lot of the same stuff applied. I remember seeing him as a freshman and saying, this kid's going to be really good defensively. You noticed it from jump. You had no idea what he was going to be offensively. That was a major question mark. Junior year, it felt like he kind of took a step forward, but he was obviously in Markel Fultz's shadow still. You hoped that when Markel left, Thibault could take some sort of a leap offensively. Now, that never happened, and we know kind of what he looked like as a junior and a senior. But defensively has always been his kind of like his first focus in terms of like what he takes pride in, his energy level. That was evident from day one, which makes me think it's not going to be that much of a struggle for him to adjust. Whereas a lot of these guys, when all they've played in is zone and you just see them with bad habits that don't translate well, it's tough to think, like, how could this guy buy into NBA defense and why is it going to be an easy adjustment?
In watching him play defense, you can see, like, he does take those risks, but he's so quick to the ball, and his jump and second jump are so elite from something I've never seen on the perimeter. Like, a guy will get by David Crisp or whatever, or just get into the mid-range, and he's so quick to, like, just come from behind him and block his shot. Do you think, and he has a 7-foot wingspan, and he his athletic testing, he didn't obviously go to the combine, but do you think that there's more like offensive potential to unlock based on how athletic he is defensively?
Yeah, I mean, it's possible that he cleans up his hand a little bit, and just if he got it onto a switch with a bigger guy who his quick first step is just too quick for, then he could, blow by for some basic layups and stuff like that. I don't know. It's tough for me to get overly geeked up about someone's offensive development at his age who's never really shown much signs of creation ability. But maybe the development staff just unlocks something that gives him confidence, and maybe they put him in situations in the second unit to explore some things, or maybe that just happens in the G League. I always get a little bit hesitant when we start talking about upside with things we haven't really seen yet for guys that age. It's one of the reasons why I looked at Brandon Clark and wasn't ready to say, yeah, this guy's going to be a three-point shooter. Like, it's just tough for me to pencil in that sort of development for guys when they haven't really shown me much reason to be optimistic. at this age.
That makes sense. Looking at a lineup when the Sixers need a stop of Zaire, Thybulle, Jimmy, Ben, Embiid, what does that lineup say to you?
That's a lineup that can switch a lot. It's a lineup that is going to give problems. There's not many types of players that can't defend. I think Thybulle could guard the Kyries of the world, and if Zaire takes a step forward, he could do that too. That doesn't mean Thybulle's going to stop Kyrie. I just think he could guard him without looking exposed or lost. But we also have this, like, at first glance, I say that's going to be a great defensive lineup. So much switchability, so much versatility. It's going to give teams problems. I also thought Zaire Smith could be a difference maker playoffs, you know, 2019 playoffs when we drafted him. I thought this could be a guy they throw out and get stops. Now, what happened with him earlier in the season, I think derailed potentially that possibility. But I also think on this team, if they're not really willing to play rookies early and they're not really willing to make them a part of the plan later to kind of push them along that path, we might just have way too high expectations for what these guys are going to be year one. And that's why I keep coming back to, I just want to see how much they play them. And if they develop them accordingly, then that could be a devastating five-man group with an insanely terrific plus-minus. I just don't know if that's realistic year one, and that's kind of concerning for a senior.
Well, it's not really. It's Mike. I love Mike. But let's hope that when we put that lineup in, we have a timeout because there are four guys there that won't shoot off the catch or can't. So at least in Ben Simmons, Jimmy Butler, Zaire Smith, and Matisse Thybulle. Like, let's hope it's the last possession of the game. That's all I'm saying, at least for now. You know, that's a one-possession lineup, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that's a lineup that offensively you may have major question marks for. It could be great in transition, but offensively, it's, you know, in the half court, it could be very stagnant. But yeah, I mean, it's defensively, that's the idea here. And some people think that Zaire and Thybulle's defensive abilities overlap. I don't think that they're the exact same type of defender. But I do think defensively they have high potential in different ways. But if you want to play them together, both need to evolve offensively.
How does the way that the Sixers treated Landry Shamet from the beginning of the year and then trading him, how does that affect like how you see this year going?
You're saying in terms of Thybulle?
Yeah, for Thybulle, even for Shake. And I mean, the fact that Shamet had a role right away and bought into that. And it seems like Thybulle and to some extent Zaire are also in line for that type of thing.
So I'll actually give credit for this idea to Mike O'Connor, who's with The Athletic and does some stuff with EV Hoops as well. He's been saying this, you know, for a couple months now. He posed the idea that we think that there's way more shooting in the league than there actually is, and that there aren't actually that many good shooters. Like, we underestimate how many there are. So I think when you get somebody like Shamet, who very quickly proves, hey, I can shoot, then he's playable, as long as he's not a complete liability defensively. And I think that is just way more important than anything else right now when you're looking for the seventh, eighth, ninth men. So that's why Shamet was able to play so much. And if you told me Thybulle could hit 42% of his three-pointers next year, then he has to be playable as well. But that's why offense is going to matter so much for both of these guys, for Zaire, for Shamet, even Shake. If these guys can come in, get hot from three, and be somebody that teams actually have to focus on defensively from three, that doesn't mean that they leave him open. It doesn't mean that they play him tight. But they have to say, shooter, capable shooter. That changes the calculus of how quickly these guys can play. That's why Shamet played so quickly, because there just are not enough shooters in the league. Shamet could do it at a high level. Shamet was playable.
Mike, do you want to ask about Mariel Shayok?
Yeah, so we texted about this a little bit, Ilan, but like, not a guy that either of us thought would be or should be drafted. 6'6", 200. Talk to me about what Mariel Shayok is and maybe if there's any upside, which I know the answer is probably not.
Well, started his career in Virginia, transferred to Iowa State, played on an Iowa State team where pretty much everybody wanted to prove that they were a point guard except for Mariel Shayok. That's a good situation for Mariel Shayok. That means he could just hunt shots, which is what he did. Quick trigger, wanted to get shots up from three. Certainly a capable shooter and could get hot. But when he's cold, he's a disaster. I think his shot selection isn't great. I think he really struggles to create space. He went to Portsmouth, the senior combine in April, had a great first game, looked like somebody that could run away and be one of the better prospects there if he could keep up the shot making. Then they put good defenders on him, shot went cold, could not get an inch on anyone, couldn't get by anybody at the rim, nothing came easy. His athleticism is just nothing special. Defensively, I think his ceiling is average at best, and he could be bad right now on that end. I don't see a ton of upside, like you're saying, Mike, and I don't think he's really a big-time shooter as much as someone that can get hot, so he's streaky. I would have gone another direction with that pick. Now, if you think he's a two-way, and if you have that agreed upon in advance, like we've discussed previously, then fine, but I think you could have been more creative with your two-way use. I would have rather had a guy like Max Strus from DePaul if we're going to go the two-way route, or even a guy like Fletcher McGee from Wofford, who I know is a big-time shooter. If I could have one of those guys who are actually pluses in that three-point shooting category, then I would rather have that than a guy like Merrill Shayok, who feels very James Anderson-y to me.
Yeah.
Oh, well, but that's a good thing.
Sure, sure. He was a very, I mean, obviously Virginia and Iowa State play very different styles offensively. But looking at the per 40 minutes, he played 3 years at Virginia, and his per 40 minutes attempts from three are 4, 3, and 3. And he went to Iowa State, and now he put up 6.6 threes per 40. Do you think that that is, and shot them at a high clip at 38.6%. Do we think that there is some more untapped shooting-wise there? I mean, he operated in the mid-range a lot. If they can force him to be just like, I mean, essentially be the guy that do the James Anderson thing, except take all those shots. I mean, he shot 88% from the line this year. Like, do you think that there is elite shooting in him?
I don't. I don't see elite shooting. I think he could be, like, at best, if the stars align, he could have a couple seasons where he's a very good shooter. I wouldn't even bet on that, because to me, there's nothing hard to defend about him. You could play him really tight and he's not going to burn you. You can just put an average defender on him in the NBA and he's not going to really outsmart him or run him off of screens. He's kind of just basic. Like, there's just nothing to him that's complex or diverse or creative. He was in the right place at the right time on this Iowa State team with four other guys who wanted to play make, and he was happy to be the shooter. It was a great role for him. An older player who kind of finally felt comfortable. I don't see the upside of him being an elite shooter. Could he have a couple years where he shoots well and he's very good and he's actually in someone's rotation? Sure. I wouldn't bet on it. And to me, like, James Anderson is just totally bargain bin, replaceable, not really an NBA player. And I think that's what Merrill Shayok ultimately ends up as.
Yep. I agree. Don't let
Well, at that point in the draft, though, you need to take somebody who is, like, willing to they might have needed somebody or wanted somebody who's willing to take a two-way. And I also think they may have tried to trade it and couldn't. So they took somebody they knew wouldn't mind a two-way, and they basically threw it away. No biggie.
Yeah,
Jordan Bone wouldn't have minded a two-way. Jordan Bone picked three picks later.
Mieoni picked a couple picks later. Kyle Guy went the next pick. I think it would have been a little bit tougher to convince Kyle Guy to take a two-way. But if Kyle Guy ends up showing any of the three-point shooting ability that he showed at Virginia, he's playable in this team. I just think there were other guys that were available, guys that went undrafted. Like, I'm a big Bryce Brown fan. I'm stunned he didn't get drafted. I think he's going to be an NBA player kind of in the Bryn Forbes mold. If you could convince Bryce Brown to take a two-way, that's highway robbery. And I would have loved to kind of find somebody like that who was towards the, like, to me, the whole point of convincing someone to take a two-way before the draft ends is to jump in front of the two-way line. It's to get somebody that's high priority two-way and just lock him up. I don't think Merrill Shayok's a high priority two-way. He's just a guy that's willing to play in a two-way potentially.
Why do you think this team has not tried to find, did not try to find a traded Shamet early and did not draft a Shamet type or even like a backup Redick?
I just don't think there was a guy that fit that mold necessarily in this draft, like someone that was the Shamet level of shooter. Maybe some people thought that like a Tyler Hero was in that mold, but he went 13. It's a different conversation. I actually don't think he's nearly as good as Shamet, but there's a different type of ability there off the dribble.
I would say Carson Edwards.
Yeah, I mean, I would say Windler was probably closer to that than Edwards. Again, Windler wasn't there, although they could have gotten him with the first potentially if they stood pat. I just don't think Carson Edwards is that type. He could have been. We talked about him last week. I just think, you know, if you could get a guy like like a Bryce Brown or like a Kyle Guy. Like, these guys just are, cost much less. And maybe they're ready to come in and you could design sets for them as a shooter, both of them. I think that's on the table. Could you have done it for Carson? Yeah, but Carson also would have created some possible negatives and liability areas in terms of himself as a creator, the way he wants to dribble, and the way he's going to defend initially. It doesn't mean he's going to be a bad defender forever, but I don't think he's ready to come into the league and be a plus defender. Guys like Bryce Brown actually could have been. Kyle Guy, he's probably going to stink defensively at first. He's just too small, too weak, completely undermanned physically. I still think those guys as shooters come back into the conversation of there are not that many shooters to be had in the NBA. If you scrape the G League and say, let's bring in the 10 best three-point shooters in the G League for a workout, most of those guys aren't going to translate to NBA three-point shooting, whether it's a Brady Heslip or like a Jarrell Eddy or an Anthony Brown. There's a reason why they're just G League lifers. And I think you might as well kick the tires on seeing a guy like Kyle Guy or a guy like Bryce Brown. Can they be better than that? Can they actually be somebody that are going to hang around the league as long as they shoot 40% from three? I don't think that's Shayok.
Yeah.
Well, that's all I got. Mike, anything?
Yeah, I mean, I think the team ethos is very clearly we like big, imposing guys on defense who can switch, defend their position, and be a dog. And we care slightly less about the offensive end, because in the season that matters, it's going to be Jimmy with the ball in his hands and Ben with the ball in his hands and Embiid down low. And I guess they think, you know, plus JJ and plus maybe Tobias. Do we think that's just like the right move, because we were, you know, that team gave Toronto the hardest time and had any of the things that I've mentioned a million times happen, then they advance in that series, and who knows? Is it trying to do too many, like, this? We have superstars and then we have this guy, role player, who can only do this thing. And did they get narrow-minded in looking for those kinds of players?
Well, I would actually argue that what you're talking about is somewhat a mentality for the majority of the league, which is essentially the way to sum up the 3-and-D movement. Let's find a guy that can shoot threes a little bit and defend a little bit, and they're more valuable than everybody else. But then what ends up happening is those guys have really low ceilings, and even if they kind of hit into that 3-and-D box that you expect them to, they're not going to become creators. They're not going to surprise you with their ability to get hot off the dribble. They're never going to be really hard to guard in the playoffs. And when, you know, it's a small sample size, just looking at a team like Toronto. But what made Fred VanVleet a difference maker in the playoffs and Pascal Siakam is that they could create. They could mismatch. They could attack. They could be confident. And the thing about the guys, even in the Covington mold, or if you want to look at like a Mikal Bridges type, is I don't think they're ever going to have that ability. They're never going to put the ball on the deck and really exploit a mismatch. That's just not who they are. And I think the more that we keep just pushing up every 3-and-D guy and letting them just take every open spot in the league, it's going to be a bubble that bursts when eventually teams put in a unit with way too many 3-and-D guys. There's only one or two guys that can dribble. And I think there's some value in balancing what you're drafting here. Take the Thibault 3-and-D type, but then give yourself a chance in the second round to uncover a gem like a Talen Horton-Tucker type. Someone that slips to 46 is years away, but maybe in a couple years, he's way better than Thibault, and he gives you a creator. Even if it's like in an Evan Turner off the bench role, the way Portland utilizes him, that's still somebody that can dribble and you can design sets for and can create for others and themselves. That holds value, and I think within a couple years, that ability, the ability to create for yourself and others, it's going to be really undervalued. And we're going to start, I think, seeing a reverse and people starting to look for that. Because I think the internet, teams, the way everybody talks about evaluating talent right now and finding new NBA players is very much 3-and-D, 3-and-D, 3-and-D. But we don't stop to think about, what about just being able to score? What about being able to dribble and score and create? And I think that's going to be what we kind of end up reversing back to, because we assume that doing that is often in an inefficient mold. It doesn't have to be. There's a difference between the inefficient Jahlil Okafor types and the inefficient like Rudy Gay types and Kevin Knox types than guys that can actually score. That's not everybody, but I think we often put a blanket statement over scores that they're always inefficient. I don't think that has to be the case.
That's why I like Carson Edwards. That's why I liked Carson Edwards. I also would think that in terms of, not to just fucking, you know, stroke the Celtics dick, but that's why, like, I think also IQ is a thing, and just like level of intelligence and court vision is a thing that gets underrated. That's why Grant Williams went so late. I think there's next level, like, if guys that can't think the game, like, aren't going to get there. And that's why it surprises me that guys take risks on. I get like, oh, this guy's so young, like maybe he can get there. The Sixers were obviously in that position where they could before, but teams that are like good, hoping that this guy ever becomes something not on their first contract, I just don't see it for the most part.
Well, I think Grant's going to be a good case study, right? Like, he goes to Boston, he's playing with Semi Ojeleye and Gershon Yabusele, who are really all competing for like the same minutes. Will he quickly leapfrog them? I'm very interested to see. Like, or is he going to be buried behind them, and is this going to be some sort of a redshirt year on a Boston team that's always had a little bit too much depth? Ty Jerome's another good case study. Really smart player, terrific basketball feel, slow as dirt, complete non-athlete. Goes to Phoenix, he's going to play alongside Devin Booker at times. How do they utilize him? How much does he play early? Even a guy like Terrence Mann on a lower end. Went to the Clippers with the 48th pick. I love Terrence Mann. He was in my top probably like 43. Terrence Mann is a really smart player on a Clippers team that has a lot of depth and some young guys, a nice balance of old guys, probably going to sign a couple free agents. Is Terrence Mann going to find his way into the court next year? Or is he a guy 3 years from now, people say, where did the Clippers find Terrence Mann from? Where did he come from? I think a lot of these guys are good case studies. And I agree, basketball IQ is undervalued. I think some teams still place a premium on it. Like Nikhil Alexander-Walker is a good example. If he wasn't a smart basketball player, he wouldn't have gone 17.
Yep.
But he's got a really good feel for the game, and that's one of the reasons why he went where he went. Yeah, I mean, I think basketball IQ is kind of like properly valued right now, maybe slightly undervalued. I will say, on a kind of different note, the one thing we saw in this draft was red flag guys, guys that have injury problems, guys that we didn't get great background on, they dropped. They slipped. And that sounds obvious, but the amount it happened that really only like Romeo Langford kind of went where he was mocked that had any sort of discussion like that. Everybody else went lower or didn't get drafted. And I think we're just officially in the age of background and intel. It's not that we didn't do that before. It's that teams place such a premium on what they're getting and digging up information that it's going to sink guys. And it did for a guy like Bol Bol, and it did to get a guy like Naz Reid to go undrafted. A guy like Jontay Porter went undrafted because of injuries. Like, we're going to see it now more than ever, and I really wonder if any of these kids moving forward decide not to play college, to go overseas, or to just return for a second year of school. I don't know what the ripple effect is going to be.
Last question, because the Sixers have only announced, aside from, I guess, Tobias Harris's brother, if you have any intel on him, and then Chris Kumaji in terms of who is coming to Summer League for the Sixers, aside from the guys they drafted.
Haven't heard officially anybody else coming to the Sixers Summer League team. Terrell Harris isn't anything special. That's really just a favor to Tobias, obviously. Kumaji doesn't stink, which doesn't sound like a sales pitch, but like we talk about like Taco Fall a lot, and Kumaji is a couple inches shorter, but he's far more mobile, can really run the floor, is not lost in a game that's changing ends quickly. I remember seeing him at Mount Verde and thinking he'd be a prospect in the future. Remember seeing him during his younger days at Florida State and thinking maybe this clicks for him. Florida State has always kind of shared their center minutes between an assortment of guys. They never feature just one center. Kumaji kind of got lost in that, but I thought he really stood out at Portsmouth. He can be a shot blocker. He can be a low-key rim runner. He has some sense of what he's doing out there. If we could get him on the summer league team, and then he becomes somebody that joins the G League team after a training camp cut, I think that's great. But I would like to see some bigger names pop onto the summer league team. I think a lot of those guys are already taken, though.
Yeah, I'm disappointed by that, as you can imagine.
yeah.
You think Kumaji as a rim protector in the NBA, or at least in summer league time, in a way that like inexplicably Boban isn't?
Yeah, I mean, he's more mobile than Boban. He's not like lead footed whatsoever. I just, whenever I think of guys his size, and I think about the Rolodex of players that I've evaluated in college, every time I watch those guys live, there's a moment where you just feel really bad for the kid, when the game speeds up and they're running back and forth and the kid's just lost and he looks like he like fell in from outer space for a second and he can't run and change ends and you're just like, God, I feel bad for that kid right now. I never felt that way about Kumaje. And it's not because I'm an asshole. It's because he's better than those guys in terms of his ability to change ends. And I think that's what separates him and actually makes him somewhat of a prospect. I wouldn't even hate it if they put him on a two-way, but he's going to need time because he's still very lean and he needs to build up. And hopefully in an NBA weight room, that will happen.
Okay.
You guys seem really down.
No. It was a weird, I'll speak for Mike, but it was a weird night for Mike in that Thibault is the guy that he wanted. Like, he'd been talking about him for 3 months, but then to really sort of just dismiss the rest of the draft basically was against Mike ethos. So it's been a battle.
It's a battle.
You know, it's a lot of eggs in the Matisse Thibault basket, I guess, for this year.
Can I pose a question for you, Mike?
Please.
So let's say that they got Windler at their where they were originally picking. And then so that they don't move up for Thibault. Thibault gets taken by OKC. They get Dylan Windler. And then with 34 or 33, they get they take two stashes. They take Didi, Luzada Silva, and they take Dervita Servitas. And let's say at 54, they walk away with Kyle Guy on a two-way. What are your thoughts?
No, I'd rather have Zeusman than Servitas, if that's okay.
Zeusman stinks, but whatever.
He stinks?
He's horrible.
He's a fake prospect.
Wow!
I like him. Very weird that he didn't get drafted, by the way. There weren't even that many stashes. The international class was really bad.
I'm telling you, in a draft where there were not enough stashes and people would have loved to find one, the fact that Zeusman didn't get drafted, it tells you everything you need to know. He stinks. Okay,
fair enough. Would I be happier than I was? I liked Windler. I had Windler somewhere around like 15 on my board. My board didn't have any centers in it, so it makes everybody's draft grade look higher. And Kyle Guy, that would have been okay. Two stashes. If one of those stashes, if Servitas was Carson Edwards, I'd feel great about it.
Okay. What if it was like Pascal instead of Servitas?
So you're saying Windler, Pascal, Kyle Guy on a two-way, and
Didi.
And Didi's stash.
Stash, yep.
I'd probably feel okay. If Thibault had gone before us and they took Windler where he was, I'd probably feel okay about it. Because I like Windler. I think his shooting off movement is really impressive. I think he'll be a Tobias-level defender of just, like, capable and big enough. And Pascal, I sort of feel similar. I kind of believe in the shot. I believe in him being like a role player, but I wasn't crazy about him. I don't know. Maybe the point you're making is the right one in that, like, not everybody. I believe in Thibault. Like, I really, really do. I don't think there's a world in which he's not a playable NBA player for a number of years. Maybe he's not starter level. Maybe his offense isn't there. But I just, the defensive instincts to me and the athleticism and the length is enough to be a guarantee that he's going to be a really useful NBA player. So maybe that's enough. Maybe you'd come out of it with one. I think I didn't have a problem. I was excited when they traded up for him, even though they used the 33rd pick. I was fine with it because I know that they didn't want to use all of them. But then to then kick all those picks away, some for future picks, some for nothing, was just a real bummer and a shot to my philosophy of loving the second round and taking as many bites at the apple as you can.
Yeah, I mean, hey, like, I'm of a similar belief that the second round is where you can really work the margins and find some cheap talent and have them, you know, for a couple of years at a cost-controlled price and develop. And so I'm with you on that. And I'm not really necessarily making a case for one or the other. I will just say Thibault was one of the higher ranked players available. The others were somebody like Kevin Porter Jr., who I actually loved and is a really good example of what background checks are kind of doing to some of these kids.
Yeah.
And another would be Kazik Pala, who I also really, really liked, but I don't think was necessarily a great fit for what the Sixers are looking for. So in terms of best player available and need, Thibault was just the perfect blend of both, and he was there, and they promised him. And we often say, well, so what? But they told the kid not to really work out. They told him not to come to the combine. It's that means something. And if they would have not taken him, doesn't mean someone took him ahead of him. But just if they let him go past them for somebody else, that creates a whole another litany of issues.
Why? Sorry, Spike, but why promise anyone? What is the benefit of that?
Well, let's say Thibel works out for teams and shoots really well and does really well, athletic testing wise, tests off the charts in Chicago. Then he could go way higher and they could have absolutely no shot at drafting him. Again, I mean, I am 13. So I kept telling people he will not be there when the Sixers pick. He's going to go way earlier than people expect. I thought that was like a lock. And 20 is not way earlier, but I think he would not have been there when the Sixers were originally picking. And had he worked out, had he gone to Chicago, I think he could have really raised his stock, and then they're at the risk of not getting him whatsoever. Now, is that player somebody worth promising? Time will tell, but I think that's probably why you promise somebody like Thibel.
Okay.
Well, thanks, man. EVHoops.com. You said you're doing one more scouting crash course this summer, right?
Right. We have one more crash course. That will be right after Summer League. It starts. It's online. And then we're also doing the Scout U Book Club, which is like 50 minutes a week through to the end of September. You can sign up for as many books as you want. We're pretty much going to be reading and then applying what we read to how we can become better evaluators.
Awesome. And you said email you directly for those things, right? Or go to the site?
Just go to, you can find information on my Twitter, at Alon Vino, or you can email me, scoutu@evhoops.com.
Thanks, man. Hope you're right about Thibel.
Well, I hope I am too.
Are you going to be at Summer League, Alon?
I'll be there. You going to be there, Mike?
I will be there.
All right, let's play some craps.
Let's do it.
Mike credentialed again for Summer League, 2 years in a row.
Am I credentialed as the Ricky big. Or as WIP?
No, it's WIP. The Ricky's not a real thing. You gotta. I mean, it would be cool to have it on the press pass, but you don't want to take a chance at not getting
That's
it.
Fair.
So it's That's your fair. WIP responsibilities. We'll take press.
Great, events. great.
All right, Alon.
Yeah. I don't know. I might wear a Horace Spencer jersey.
All right, man. Thanks, buddy.
Thanks, bud.
All right, Mike. Well, we are on the doorstep of free agency starts this week. We'll talk to you midweek. Hopefully there's some news by then. And then next Sunday at 6 p.m. is when it starts.
Wow.
So big, very exciting. Very exciting for everyone.
And I booked my hotel in Vegas, so especially exciting.
There you go. Exciting for literally everybody. Literally everybody. All right. Are you done with TTP?
Yeah, lick face.
We are the murderous pair. That went to jail and we murdered the murderers there. Then went to hell and discovered the devil delivered some hurt and despair. Used to have power to push. Now I smoke pounds of the push. Holy, I'm burning the bush. Now I give a fuck about none of this shit. True runner over and out of this bitch. To the spotlight. Copying of uppers and downers get done. I'm in a rush to be numb. Dropping 1,000 ain't much. Come from the clouds on a missile.